Avenue, sung by Harry Lauder, Edison Records.
I've just come from a wedding or a funeral, a christening or something of the kind. And the stuff that I've been drinking's took my noddle. And what or where I've been, I can't mind. I feel as brave as any highway robber. I've the courage of a dozen men that knew. I'm a miserable devil when I'm sober. But I'm very, very happy when I'm full. This is the whiskey cup I'm going to think. When I was going up the stair last night, the wife cries, "Didn't you see it? Is that you, John?" I said, "Aye, my hen, it's me." "Who was you expecting?" Oh, dear me, I'm telling you. And I'm fool, I know. Absolutely fool. That I adore the country I was born in. My name is Jock McGraw, and I didn't care a straw for something in the bottle for the morning.
KZSU FM Stamford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, and welcome to another edition of what is the first discussion that we have done of cylinders, the earliest, or one of the earliest, perhaps the earliest, we'll have to talk to our guest about it, recorded sound medium. Hearsay Culture, KZSU. I am Dave Levine. I am an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. And that was Foo the New by Harry Lauder, a 1908 Edison cylinder. Not normal radio show fodder, not normal content for KZSU. But then again, this is an unusual show today. Today I'm very excited to have on David Soibert, the acting head of special collections at UC Santa Barbara. We are going to be discussing today a project that I became familiar with back in 2005 when I was doing a fellowship at Stanford. And the project is the Cylinder Preservation and Digitization Project, a project of UCSB where UCSB has taken upon itself to digitize thousands of cylinders, these early recorded medium that roughly span the period from 1890 roughly to through the 1920s. We are also going to be discussing today a related project, perhaps a larger project, and one that is certainly one that we are going to begin our discussion with, the discography of Victor recordings through the Library of Congress, a project which is in some ways more ambitious, although I think both projects are quite exciting. What's going on here? We have a situation where you've got these recorded sounds that run the range from music to spoken word to historical speeches to literally recordings of people practicing music, people talking about their lives. And these particular sound recordings are in formats which are archaic, to say the least. I suspect if I did the proverbial show of hands of Hearsay Culture listeners and asked how many people own a cylinder, a few people might say they own a cylinder. If I asked how many people own a cylinder player, the answer is probably zero. And then if I asked the question, perhaps the most interesting one from a copyright perspective, how many people have heard the song Foo the New by Harry Lauder from 1908, I also suspect that unless you were paying attention to the Cylinder Digitization and Preservation Project, the answer would be I've never heard of it. So where is the market for this? The market is in, primarily, although we will talk about this with David, in historic preservation. And so we are going to have an extended discussion of these efforts to preserve this amazing history of recorded sound, not just in the U.S., but worldwide. We're going to talk about both of these projects and get into some of these recordings. David's work is, again, work that I came across when I was doing a fellowship at Stanford CIS, and the project immediately captivated me. And I'm probably, I would imagine, I'll ask David this question, one of the few people that actually has cylinders on his iPhone. And so I've actually listened to a few of these from time to time at leisure, and not just because of their historic interest. So we're going to have that discussion today, and I'm going to work in some music from time to time. But I'm very excited to talk to David, who is joining us via Skype today. Thank you much for, first, your flexibility in scheduling, David, but more importantly, for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's start off with a question that I ask all of my guests. Talk a little bit more about your background and how you became interested broadly in these preservation projects.
Well, I think that my interest, I've always had an interest in music dating back as far as I can remember. But it really started when I was in an undergraduate in college. And aside from coursework that I was doing, the two things that I was doing during college that I absolutely loved. I was working at the campus radio station, which had an incredible library of mostly popular music recordings. And then I was also working at the music library on campus as well, which has sort of a completely different approach to how to preserve and make culture accessible. On the one hand, in the Conservatory of Music, you had high culture being preserved, or what they would call art music, serious music, and on the other hand, in the radio station was, indie, alternative, punk, hip-hop, that sort of thing, where the people that were interested in that congregated. And it didn't really gestate immediately, but over time, I realized there was a connection between these two things, that there was really, in terms of the musical culture that was being preserved, that academic libraries in particular were not preserving, they were being selective about what was being preserved. The popular, the ephemeral, that sort of thing was really not given the credit it needed. I went off to library school studying audio preservation. And then I ended up at the University of California, Santa Barbara, which happened to have an incredible archive of early sound recordings. And that was my opportunity then to sort of practice what I preached, which was trying to preserve recordings and music that had really been overlooked in academic libraries.
Now, let me ask by way of background, and this is for the edification of the listeners who may not be familiar. So we met each other through work I was doing at Stanford and through an association called the Association for Recorded Sound Collectors. And I think it's useful to start there before we get into, and I want to really ask these structural questions both about the Cylinder Project and about the Victor recordings. But what is ARSC?
The Association for Recorded Sound Collections is an organization that's been around since the late 60s, and it consists of librarians, archivists, historians, recording engineers, all sorts of people who are interested in the preservation of our recorded sound heritage. And, there's other organizations that work on the peripheries of this field, but the membership of ARSC is really the people that are in the trenches day in, day out as curators and custodians of collections or as reissue engineers who are remastering decayed and dying formats for reissue and things like that. And I've been involved in ARSC for about 15 years now. And that's, it's just a terrific way to network with people that are also doing this sort of work, interested in the topic, interested in the copyright issues that surround early sound recordings, and it's a way for people to not work in isolation on these, because there is no other sound archivist at UC Santa Barbara, so the only way to share information is to network with the people in similar positions at other universities or radio archives, things like that.
And that gets to my, another background question. You know, in terms of music libraries, can you give me a sense of the prevalence? How many libraries like this are out there? And I don't mean necessarily about cylinders, but just more broadly sound history libraries. And talk briefly about their structure. How do they operate within a university setting, for example?
Well, I don't think I'm qualified to speak generally about music libraries, but most large academic universities will have a music library of some sort or a music collection which includes materials for teaching and scholarship and things like that. But there's relatively few institutions that have large archival collections, and there's even fewer institutions that have large archival collections of commercial recordings, which is primarily what UC Santa Barbara has. And by that, I would narrow it down to things like the cylinder recordings and the 78 RPM discs that kind of coexisted and then supplanted the cylinder recording in the teens and 20s. I mean, I think we can probably count on two hands the number of large collections of, I should say public collections of early commercial recordings. There are still obviously private collectors that have amassed vast archives of their own of early recordings.
Mm-hmm. And you know, just in my experience at Stanford, I know Stanford has one. My alma mater, Cornell, and Peter Hurdle are others. Are there any? And narrowing down to this limited number of libraries, are there any particular characteristics that would explain both the limited number of libraries, but also what drives an institution to create such a library? Is it serendipity? Is it a strategic plan? What's your sense of how these libraries come about, because they are both remarkable and I think from a historical perspective essential, but as you said, these are commercial recordings, but they're commercial recordings where the market no longer exists. So what do you say to that?
I would say that the decision of a university at whatever point they made to establish a large sound archive, there's the Archive of Recorded Sound at Stanford, which is well known, and it's been around for 50 years, and the one at Santa Barbara, which was established in the late 60s, early 70s. I don't think they were strategic at all. I think they largely came out of the passion of a particular individual within the library of the university, but probably on the quiet, sort of started collecting these sorts of things, and they gained momentum and prominence, and now years later. We have, just a handful, and they're too expensive and complicated to run for anybody to really seriously consider starting one at this point, at least in the sense of there's plenty of room for every university archive should have grave concerns about preserving their audio collections. But in terms of the early commercial recordings, I don't think we're going to see any new ones established anytime soon.
Now, since you mentioned it, I should ask, I mean, is that literally an issue of the relative, thin resources that universities have now, or is it a bigger issue or question than that?
I think it's largely, it's an issue of resources. I don't think people would put the staff, and even developing a collection at this point would be more difficult because so much of these recordings have either been, they were taught, it was ephemeral when it came out. People enjoyed them for a few years. Think of your cassette tapes that maybe if you're from that era when you were buying cassette tapes, you listen to your car, they get melted in the back on the dashboard, and eventually you kind of put your cassette tapes on the curb and they disappeared. 78s and cylinders were similar to that. CDs, people take a little bit of care of, and LPs, that sort of thing. But I think that amassing a big collection in this day and age would be much more difficult than it was in the 50s and the 60s when the world was just awash with these records that nobody cared about.
Let's talk about the related project, and we can dig in a little bit here. The Encyclopedic Discography of Victor Recordings. What is that, and what, if anything, is its relationship to the Cylinder Project?
Well, I think something important to remember about historical sound recordings from this era is really the collecting, the documenting of these recordings was largely carried out by collectors and individuals, what we in academia would call independent scholars. So people that aren't tenured faculty and on the payroll with job security. It was really passionate people that were passionate about the music, were passionate about the equipment, that started amassing, these collections. Help me out with the rest of that question, David.
Oh yeah, sure. And so in terms of the relationship, right, between the Victor collection and the Cylinder collection, if any.
Right. And so the Victor discography, which is now based at UC Santa Barbara, is not so much a preservation project, it is a documentary project, much like a bibliography or an editing project, where we're documenting every recording session made by the Victor Talking Machine Company between 1900 and 1950. And back to my previous point, this project was started by private collectors back in the 1960s. It now has an institutional home which provides it stability and funding and that sort of thing. But it was really the passions of those private individuals that is the reason any of this stuff, whether the documentary evidence about it or whether it's the recordings themselves, have been preserved.
Now, David, we're talking about David Soibert of UC Santa Barbara's Cylinder Preservation Project on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, as you think about these projects, and I do want to kind of discuss the scope, right? You mentioned a little bit about how these recordings, were discarded, at least with regard to Cylinders, and with regard to the Victor Project, you are including in your collection not only commercial recordings, right, but demos and alternate takes of music and things like that. What is today the prevalence of this media? In other words, yeah, I have seen and I have purchased random Cylinders on eBay just as curiosities. But if someone actually wanted to build a collection today, are these Cylinders and Cylinders in particular all that prevalent? I mean, can you find them? And if so, can you talk a little about their condition, in terms of where we stand today and the accessibility of this original medium?
Well, there's a couple interesting points there. I think the most important thing to remember is back, let's say the heyday of the Cylinder era, which let's say it starts in about 1901 when Edison began mass producing and molding cylinders. And he made hundreds of millions of them. I mean, they were as common as CDs at the little Starbucks or 7-Eleven sort of thing. And through the teens, World War I around, when the format started to decline, they sold hundreds of millions of these cylinders. My guess today is that the number of extant copies is in the low millions, which may seem like a lot, but you can go into 100 thrift stores or record stores and never encounter a cylinder. Mm-hmm. There are large collections in institutions and private collections, and there is a market largely through auctions and things. You can go on eBay and find them. But the attrition rate is what's so remarkable, is that out of hundreds of millions that were made, a tiny fraction of a percent still exist. And there were maybe 75,000 titles recorded during this time period. And as an example, the UC Santa Barbara Library we have about 15,000 cylinders in our collection. The Library of Congress, Syracuse, and Santa Barbara are probably the three largest collections in the country. And all told, those three collections, there's only about 50,000 cylinders between those three collections. So you can see, they're just not that many out there. That being said, you could go out tomorrow and find one and buy one. But building a collection of any size or substance would be difficult at this point today.
So I'm sorry, go ahead, yeah.
Just one final point, and particularly among the early titles, many, many have been lost. Mm-hmm. In the film preservation community, they have a statistic about such and such percentage of silent movies before a certain time period have lost. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but let's say it's 50%. It's a really significant number. And with cylinder recordings, especially when you get into the early ones around the turn of the 20th century, you know, there's many, many. I mean, they were recording cylinders in Cuba and Puerto Rico and Mexico, and they're literally impossible to find now.
Hmm.
But popular. And recordings are relatively well preserved.
And so I mentioned that for example, the previous recording that we played was an Edison cylinder. Talk to us a little bit about who was making these cylinders. Edison was a big player, but who else was out there? Were there any other big names? I mean, Edison is a name that most people today would recognize, even if they weren't aware that Edison was making cylinders. Are there any other major players like that?
Yeah, the other one would be Columbia. Mm-hmm. Edison started in New Jersey. Columbia started in Washington, D.C. Both of them started in the very late 1880s or 1890s. And those were really the predominant manufacturers of cylinders through that whole time period. Columbia, however, made the transition to making disc recordings, and that's why we still know the name today, because Columbia has been making recordings for over 100 years. It's now part of Sony. Edison, however, Edison did make disc recordings, but didn't successfully transition to a sustainable disc format, and they went out of the record manufacturing business in 1928.
So let me ask you this, and by way of this background, and again, you know, and perhaps it's the first question I should have asked, but I dug right in on the library issues. So let's take a step back with one more background question. So, What's a cylinder? I mean, describe it. I mean, this is radio, of course. The easiest thing to do would be to hold one up and point to it. So I'm going to ask you to use your descriptive powers. What is a cylinder? Can you describe it technologically for us?
Well, all you people in your cars driving, put your knee on the steering wheel and pull out your smartphone and Google it. Actually, a cylinder is about the size of, say, a Coke can. It's hollow. And running around the outside in a spiral are the grooves that hold the information on the cylinder. Originally they were made out of wax. They would play back on it. The technology isn't really that much different from a record player in terms of a stylus moving in a groove and picking up the motion and the captured sound waves in that groove, but it was a tube with grooves around the outside rather than a flat record. And they played for 2 minutes, and then over time there were various technological advancements in cylinder production where they introduced 4-minute cylinders, and then they introduced what are called indestructible cylinders, which were made out of plastic or other hard materials that when you dropped them they wouldn't break.
And yeah, and that gets to another point that I want to, you know, ask you by way of background, which is the sustainability of the format. You know, one of the things that I came to learn as I was doing the work I was doing at Stanford was that perhaps, and correct me if I'm wrong, the cylinder format is actually, in terms of preservation, a more stable format than some of the later formats that appeared. And so I vividly remember, for example, talking to a librarian, and in fact visiting a library, and I'll protect the innocent, but a library that had a collection. And this librarian was showing me cylinders and saying, these cylinders are in great shape, but we have all of these literally rusty metal recordings from the 40s and 50s that have not been well preserved. So with regard to cylinders, I mean, is it fair to say that in terms of literally the sustainability of the format, the ability of these things to survive, that they are in any way more or better medium for purposes of preservation than later formats, including vinyl and CDs and things like that? What's your take on the cylinder format from a preservation standpoint?
Well, we have the benefit of 100 years of hindsight now to kind of see the stability of the format. But when these formats were designed, no recording format was designed with preservation in mind. They were designed for convenience was the number one thing. Sound quality was important as well. I think that cylinders are in fact a terrible preservation media. I mean, the wax.
So you have corrected me because I'm wrong.
I won't say you're wrong, David, but the wax ones are incredibly fragile, which is why we see so few preserved, particularly from the 1890s. So few of them have been preserved, just because they would, you know, some of them you look at funny and they'll break. And then the later ones that were meant to be indestructible, the plastic ones, because of the nature of the plastics, they've shrunk and deformed over time, so you have difficulty playing some of those back as well. Now, almost every media, with the exception of 78 RPM discs and vinyl LPs, almost every recording media has problems. Some of them we're just beginning to see, but cassette tapes are a terrible preservation media. Open reel tape has been remarkably long lived, but has nearing the end of its lifespan in many cases. Wire recordings can be a thicket of problems, literally. So cylinders are really, and that's why we began the project at UC Santa Barbara, is they have a mystique to them because they're so foreign to people now. But they're also one of the formats that was in most desperate need of preservation. And also they were, because of that and because of the odd format, so few people were able to listen to them that the content was really lost. I mean, if you wanted to hear that Harry Lauder cylinder that you played at the beginning of the program, you would have had to go and talk to your collector friends and kind of network with people until you found a copy of it that you could listen to.
Hmm. And that gets to a one more background question, and we'll take a short break with a music break from the Cylinder of the Day right-hand side feature you offer on the UCSB website. And, of course, you can find the Cylinder Project at cylinders.library.ucsb.edu. The numbers that you threw out with regard to the survival of cylinders are quite stark, right? And so my rough math, and this is basic math that I can do, is roughly a third, I think you're suggesting, of recorded cylinders we know to be gone. Assuming that roughly that's the number, I'm assuming that there are recordings that you or the other major libraries might have that, as far as you know, are unique. Is that a fair statement?
That's absolutely true. And in the 1890s, the cylinders were essentially unique. They would record them one at a time. And if you wanted to sell more than one copy, you had to have the person record multiple times. Sometimes they would use multiple machines, so you might get, 10 copies of a performance. But there are many titles in our collection, and probably all the other major collections, which are essentially unique.
Mm-hmm. Let's play before, and we'll take a short PSA break. But again, I think that this is a good opportunity to do it. And by the way, we will talk after the break about how it is that I can play these cylinders on a podcast. For those people who have been listening to Hearsay Culture since its inception, which still shocks me to say that the show is now over 6 years old, almost 7 years old now. You will know that the early shows that I did when I was actually physically live at KZSU, I played music. Perhaps one of my proudest moments was playing the Sting song, If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free, when Richard Epstein, one of the famed libertarians in legal thought, was on the show. I would air those recordings when the show was live on KZSU, but then I had to edit those songs out when it became a podcast, and now that I record the show in what I euphemistically call the East Coast Studios of KZSU, which is a euphemism for my basement in Greensboro, North Carolina, I don't bother with music. So, after the break, we will talk about how it is that I can play this music and perhaps the implications of it. We're chatting with David Soibert, acting head of special collections of the UCSB Santa Barbara Cylinder Preservation and Digitization Project, as well as heavily involved in the Cyclopedic Discography of Victor Recordings, which is also available through the UCSB Library at victor.library.ucsb.edu. But let's play another recording from the collection. This is There's A Mother Always Waiting for You at Home, by Will Oakland and Chorus, an Edison Blue Amberol recording from 1913. So let's listen to this as another example of what's available.
There's your pocket, not a penny.
Listening to KZSU FM Stamford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stamford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stamford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope you continue to listen to the show and to listen to KZSU and consider making a donation. You know, David, you know, listening to that song, I mean, you know, the historical preservation issues, I think, are quite stark, because obviously, you know, these are recordings that, in the case of 1913, right, are happening in the midst of a world war that has, you know, begun. And you know, I'm actually, and I plan to play later in the show, a speech by Theodore Roosevelt that you've also preserved. I'm curious, you know, in terms of the use of this music, aside from the novelty of hearing recordings that have not been listened to for decades, and I'm comfortable saying that there's a good chance that the song that I just played has not been played on a radio station for decades, or perhaps, you know, depending on how old the recording is, may not have not been played at all. In terms of its historical relevance, you know, and as someone who's run this library, do you have any stories or experiences of how this library has been used in ways that I think perhaps underscore its value as a resource, not just to the public, but to the world at large?
Well, I think there's a lot of the uses of the website are diverse. One use is that there's a lot of people out there that just love old music and old recordings, and this website, it was at the time that it debuted in 2005, this was really the first time that you could go to a place and listen to these old recordings in any sort of quantity, and, you know, listen to that last performer, Will Oakland, who kind of, you know, the sentimental genre of songs from that time period didn't really have much commercial life beyond that. I mean, there are, you know, jazz recordings, blues recordings, country recordings, you know, particularly from the 20s, have taken on a life of their own. And they've come out on reissues over and over and over again. And we've really never had any problem with access or preservation of those recordings. You know, these genres like Will Oakland, you know, he was popular for a bit, and the style went out of fashion. You know, I can't imagine that he ever came out on CD. I mean, I could, you know, these days everything's out on CD, it seems, but, you know, not widely accessible. So there's that appeal, just, you know, people who are interested in this sort of thing. And then there's, you know, academic and scholarly use as well, where people, I know that numerous people around the country and around the world use the site for, you know, as a source for recordings to play in their classrooms, whether it's for popular music courses or ethnomusicology courses and that sort of thing. And then there's also commercial and entertainment uses. I mean, people use the music on this, in films and television shows, setting, you know, the background ambience. If you're doing a, I won't name a name, but if you're doing a television show about Atlantic City in the 1920s, I mean, where are you going to get your sound recordings from? Well, our site's pretty pretty easy way to do that. So right. There's a lot of uses of the site. I don't have current download statistics, but the last time I looked, there were something on the order of songs had been downloaded or streamed in the neighborhood of 17 million times. Which is not iTunes billion or anything, but for a fairly obscure niche of popular culture, I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, it is remarkable. Look, I mean, as I've indicated, and listeners of the show know, you know, I have people and projects on the show whose work I admire and respect, and you know, I'm in awe of this project, and perhaps, you know, that in part it becomes from my general interest in collecting, in particular. My wife Heidi is very happy that I have places to talk about my interest in collecting, as opposed to my wife's view, which is, why do we have some of this stuff around? And so your project here, I think, is remarkable, and it's really a public service that deserves a lot of attention. Let's talk about this copyright issue, right? Now, you're not an attorney, and I said up front, nor am I asking you to discuss anything of a confidential or attorney-client privilege nature. So now we've gotten the caveats out of the way, because you're being interviewed by a lawyer. And you're being interviewed by someone, you know, who's talked to you about these issues at length over the course of several years. Let's talk about copyright law. I I've spoken to Arsk a few times, and the last time I spoke a few years ago, up in Rochester, I opened up my remarks by saying that I'm sorry to have to be here. I'm sorry to have to talk to you about copyright law. Now, I don't want to load the dice too much, but let's start at the top level. You know, what is, you know, as an archivist, again, you know, someone involved in preserving recordings, roughly spanning, in this case, from the 1890s and 1920s, how does copyright law fit into what you're doing here? Where is copyright arising?
Well, the funny thing is, copyright doesn't fit into it. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a librarian or archivist and you're dealing with prints and photographs and newspapers and books and journals and all that kind of stuff, you know, the federal copyright law has been around for forever, basically. You know, since the early days of the Republic, and it's pretty cut and dry of what you can do and what you can't do. With sound recordings, David, of course, you know this, but the listeners may not realize that Congress sort of left sound recordings out of the copyright law when they were being revised, and they didn't get around to including sound recordings as copyrightable creations until 1972. So that means not just the cylinder recordings in the 78 RPMs, but even, you know, LPs and that sort of thing up until the 70s were not protected and are not protected by federal copyright law. And federal copyright law is, gives the rights holders, you know, the right to sell and exploit the works and things like that. But federal copyright law also has mechanisms built in to allow libraries to preserve things, to allow libraries to do interlibrary loan and to share things, to allow scholars to use quotations for fair use and all that. And when you're talking about early sound recordings where there is no federal copyright protection on these documents, all those things go out the window. There's no fair use. There's no preservation exemption in the law. So librarians and archivists are stuck in a situation where we know we need to do something, and federal law doesn't allow us to do something. And it's kind of put these recordings in a real limbo land where everybody's afraid to do anything, to preserve them, to provide access to them. And I don't want to say we ignored that when we did the copyright law, when we did the Cylinder Project. But the nice thing about these cylinders is that the majority of them were recorded by Edison. And Edison went out of business in 1928. There is no corporate successor that anybody knows of to the Edison company that owns the Edison recordings. So we felt we were on pretty safe ground by digitizing them and putting them online.
So they're viewed, or you view them as largely abandoned property, to put it that way, or how would you characterize Edison recordings?
Yeah, I don't know what the legal term
is. No, I understand it. As a librarian, I'm asking you.
Yeah, abandoned property, orphan works, would all apply to the Edisons. We have other recordings on our website. We have recordings by Columbia. We have recordings by Pathé. In particular, both of those have corporate successors as well. So we're on less firm legal ground there. But, you know, Columbia Recordings hasn't ever reissued a cylinder, to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You could say they're banned. That doesn't make us 100% in the clear legally, but preservation was essential here. And the only way to preserve these, and particularly to secure funding for the preservation, was to provide access to them. We couldn't just digitize them and lock them up for some future day when the law is different. Nobody would have given us money to do that.
I feel compelled to ask, have you had any contact with Columbia or Pathé or any of the other putative, and again, you have to put this with the asterisk, we don't know, potential copyright owners? Have they had any contact with you, or have they said anything about this project that you're aware of?
No, we've never gotten any sort of communication from anybody that might be a rights holder, in this case. And the other half of the sound recording question is that the underlying musical work to a sound recording, the composition, the song, the words, would be copyrighted as well. And you could copyright that portion, but those have all expired. So the musical content of these is all in the public domain. It's the recording itself that is in legal limbo.
You're a librarian, you're familiar with these issues, but you mentioned collectors, right? And I've met a number of collectors, and others when I've attended ARCS conferences and just through my own research. Your sense of copyright, is informed by being an archivist. But for the average collector, right, who's out there buying these recordings, of course, copyright law has the general, notion of the first sale doctrine, meaning that one can legally sell a authorized copy of a recording. So one can buy a cylinder and then sell the cylinder. But what do collectors, and I'm not asking you to speak for them, but your sense, what do collectors think about the state of copyright law here? I mean, like I said, I was not happy that I had to even discuss copyright law with you. My personal view is that copyright law has no place here because its purpose has already been achieved for purposes of these recordings. But what's the view of the collecting community generally as far as the imposition, if you will, or just the existence of having to think about copyright on these issues?
Well, I think your average collector of recordings, whether they're these early ones or LPs, have no idea about this. I mean, when you think about, copyright on the 1960s Beatles recordings are all pre-1972 recordings. So while the songwriting rights are still owned by the heirs, the recording isn't protected by federal copyright law. But I don't think anybody's aware of that. Mm-hmm. The people in ARSC and the librarians, archivists, professionals, understand these issues, but the average person doesn't have any concept of pre-72 sound recording copyright issues.
And there haven't been, I mean, have there been enforcement actions that you're familiar with around cylinders? I mean, are you aware of any litigation involving the preservation of cylinders or any other recorded sound medium predating 72?
I'm not aware of any actions regarding audio preservation for pre-72. There have been commercial issues of pre-72 recordings where there's been legal action, the Naxos versus Capitol lawsuit from, I don't remember the year off the top of my head, but from about 10 years ago now, was an important case for pre-72 recordings.
So let me ask you, in the last couple of minutes that we have, in terms of, and I'll ask you this broad question. I mean, in terms of plans both for the Cylinder Project and for Victor, where are you headed? I mean, these aren't done in that sense, but what do you see as the plans for both over the next, the short-term horizon, next 2 to 5 years?
Well, the Cylinder Project is a fairly stable project at this point. It's been around for 10 years. The site has doubled in content. We started out with about 5,000 recordings. Now there's well over 10,000. The collection continues to grow. We have close to 2,000 cylinders that are, they're cataloged, but they haven't been digitized yet. It takes time to do, and I'll put in my own plug here too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, please.
We're always, looking for support and funding for preservation efforts like this. And we will continue, as far as I can tell, that we will continue to acquire and digitize cylinders as long as there are new titles to acquire and digitize. More broadly, and as it relates to the what you brought up about Victor, is we've been collaborating with the Library of Congress on the National Jukebox Project, which is a two-sided project. One is we're doing the discographic work, the cataloging, if you could say, of the early sound recordings, and we're then digitizing as well. And we started out by putting online 10,000 early Victor recordings. We are continuing to digitize recordings. We have support now from the Packard Humanities Institute, which is based out of Los Altos up in the Bay Area, and so they've been very generous in supporting our work. And that discographic work then, combined with the digitization, is we're moving into other areas, which includes Columbia Records, OK Records, and Brunswick Records. And I want to add here, though, the difference between the Cylinder site and the discography and the National Jukebox is that's done with the permission of Sony Music in New York. So they said to the Library of Congress and also then to UC Santa Barbara through a kind of a sub-agreement was that you have permission to digitize anything recorded before March of 1925, basically the acoustic era. But the fact remains is we shouldn't have to ask permission to digitize recordings that should be out of copyright if the copyright law for sound recordings wasn't broken. Mm-hmm. This should be just something that we do as a matter of our business.
And what's the status of your and ARSC's efforts to attempt to influence policy in that regard?
Well, the Library of Congress undertook a study and then issued a plan. It's called the National Recording Preservation Plan, which came out in January. It's online. If you Google, you'll find it. And that outlines major areas that need to be addressed in order to preserve our sound recording legacy. And some of these include things like education, copyright reform, technological obsolescence, and that sort of thing. So the National Recording Plan is a path forward for preserving sound recordings, but it doesn't have a mechanism. Of course, there's no funding attached to it, and you know, it's, but at least it leads us in the right direction.
Yeah, the, and, you know, in our closing couple of minutes, you know, the plug is important because we're, again, we are talking about, and as you mentioned earlier, we're talking about activities that, you know, in theory should and would be funded by government, right? If you're talking about preserving the sound, recorded sound history, of our country where there is no commercial market, that would seem to be the role of government. I'm curious as you, you know, pull out your crystal ball. You said that, you know, you don't envision that other major libraries would develop. Do you envision, therefore, that there's going to be more loss of this recorded history? We already, you know, like I said, you already mentioned a third of these recordings are gone. Or do you think that the work of your library and others has done a good enough job to keep this history in check? Well, I mean, you know, given everything, you know, our tight financial conditions, both private and public, pull out your crystal ball and tell us where we're headed.
Well, I don't need a crystal ball to know that the efforts of libraries and archives to preserve these recordings are woefully insufficient. We are facing, I might even say, catastrophic loss in some areas. I mean, we digitize recordings all the time at Santa Barbara. There are other institutions doing the same. But there's just not enough equipment and technical expertise and grant funding and that sort of thing to save but a fraction of the material that's held in public archives right now, let alone the stuff that is, you know, in garages and basements and other places like that. There's no question, and particularly when you get, this is veering off, but when you get to video, mm-hmm. Which has the same sort of problems, there's going to be whole chunks of our history that are lost because somebody will open up the box in 5 years and they'll either find goo or the equipment won't exist or nobody remembers how to manufacture the heads any longer, the tape heads, that sort of thing.
And so that's going to be really, you know, my last question for you is, and I'm giving you the open floor here. The average listener interested in this issue, what should they do to aid in what I, again, to be clear, what I think is a critical and largely ignored, to be clear, at least by policymakers, effort to preserve these recorded sound recordings. What do you recommend for the average listener? What could, if anything, could they do?
Well, I think that, you know, if people have any capacity to financially support the operations of libraries and archives that are doing this sort of thing, get involved, because the money is needed now. It's not, in 5 or 10 years, it's going to be even more expensive to do this work. So get involved. I mean, you know, places like the Internet Archive and Google Books have done tremendous work, with scanning, printed works and things like that. But we need that kind of activity with, recorded sound as well. And the other thing I would say, which is a kind of a political issue, is that there is a role for government in this sort of thing. Our initial funding was from the Institute for Museum and Library Services, which is a federal agency that supports libraries and museums. The grant, you know, when you compare it to the kind of money that's spent on defense or on science, you know, the grant was $215,000, which was enough to preserve those initial 6,000 recordings and establish a program that is lived now for 10 years and continues to do this work. I mean, that's peanuts, really. So there is a role for government here. I mean, people want the private enterprise to do everything. But, you know, frankly, private enterprise, there's no financial benefit to doing this. And the only way to do it is for government or philanthropic foundations to step in and take up that charge.
David Soybert, acting head of special collections at UC Santa Barbara, and the acting head of not only the Cylinder Preservation Digitization Project, but also involved in the encyclopedic discography of Victor Recordings. Thank you so much, David. We've been talking for several years, literally, about you being on the show. I've wanted to have you on. I think I've wanted to have you on literally since I launched the show in 2006. So you are the most delayed guest, not for lack of interest. And the recent delays, of course, are on my end. Thank you so much for being being on the show. Thank you for taking the time today. And most importantly, thank you for the work that you're doing, which again, I am an enormous fan of, as a history buff, but also as one who is extremely interested in how we can use technology to preserve our history. I just want to thank you for the work that you and your colleagues have done. And you know, I'm a fan of not only you, but Sam Barlowski and Tim Brooks and the others who I've met. So it's a thrill to have you on the show today, and thank you for taking the time.
Great. Thanks for having me on. I'm glad we could finally do it.
Let me, rather than do what my typical ending of the show, which is to talk about upcoming guests, I'm going to actually close the show with another recording from the Cylinder Preservation and Digitization Project. This is a speech by Teddy Roosevelt, titled Social and Industrial Justice, an Edison Blue Amberall recording from 1919. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day. And here is President Teddy Roosevelt.
Our prime concern is that in dealing with the fundamental law of the land, in assuming finally to interpret it and therefore finally to make it, the acts of the course of the court should be subject to and not above the final control of the people as a whole. I deny that the American people have surrendered to any set of men, no matter what their position or their character, the final right to determine those fundamental questions upon which free self-government ultimately depends. The people themselves must be the ultimate makers of their own constitution. And where their agents differ in their interpretations of the Constitution, the people themselves should be given the chance, after full and deliberate judgment, authoritatively to settle what interpretation it is that their representatives shall thereafter adopt as binding. We do not question the general honesty of the courts, but in applying to present-day social conditions the general prohibitions that were intended originally as safeguards to the citizen against the arbitrary power of government in the hands of caste and privilege. These prohibitions have been turned by the courts from safeguards against political and social privilege into barriers against political and social justice and advancement. Our purpose is not to impugn the courts, but to emancipate them from a position where they stand in the way of social justice, and to emancipate the people in an orderly way from the iniquity of enforced submission to a doctrine which would turn constitutional provisions which were intended to favor social justice and advancement into prohibitions against such justice and advancement. In the last 20 years, an increasing percentage of our people have come to depend on industry for their livelihood. So that today the wage workers in industry rank in importance side by side with the tillers of the soil. As a people, we cannot afford to let any group of citizens or any individual citizen live or labor under conditions which are injurious to the common welfare. Industry, therefore, must submit to such public regulation as will make it a means of life and health, not of death or inefficiency. We must protect the crushable elements at the base of our present industrial structure. We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupations. The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, but must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living, a standard high enough to make morality possible, to provide for education and recreation, to care for immature members of the family, to maintain the family during periods of sickness, and to permit a reasonable saving for old age. Hours are excessive if they fail to afford the worker sufficient time to recuperate and return to his work thoroughly refreshed. We hold the night work of labor and women, that the night labor of women and children is abnormal and should be prohibited. We hold that the employment of women over 48 hours per week is abnormal and should be prohibited. We hold the seven-day working week is abnormal. We hold that one day of rest in seven should be provided by law. We hold that the continuous industries operating 24 hours out of 24 are abnormal, where because of public necessity or for technical reasons, such as molten metal, the 24 hours must be divided into two shifts of 12 hours or three shifts of eight. They should, by law, be divided into three of eight.